Lecture 18, Strange Bedfellows.
Welcome back. When Xenophon and his army of 10,000 Greek mercenaries finally succeeded in fighting their way out of the Persian Empire and returning home to mainland Greece, they discovered then in the early 390s BC that the world had changed during the years when they were in Persia. When they left Greece back in 401 BC, Athens was in the depths of defeat and despair. Persia had teamed up with Sparta and the Spartan allies to destroy the Athenian Empire, to force Athens to surrender, to tear down the long walls that tied Athens to its port city of Piraeus and guaranteed Athenian freedom and sea power. All this was gone, and it seemed gone irrevocably. And a famous Athenian named Thucydides, who wrote a history called The History of the Peloponnesian War, had assumed also that his home city of Athens was finished, and that year, 404 BC, the year of Athens' surrender, that was the year that he marked as the end of the war, the end of Athenian sea power and independence. A war that had lasted 27 years was finally over. Well, the only reason Thucydides thought this was that he didn't live long enough to see the resurgence of Athens, just as Persian gold and Persian support for Sparta had been able to defeat Athens. In the years to come, the Persians changed their allegiance. They now supported Athens against Sparta, and we will see this time how they got Athens back on its feet, and in fact, in a way Thucydides never could have dreamed, brought his city back to prominence. There was at this time, of course, in Sparta, a man named Lysander. He was the great charismatic visionary who had seen the right way to defeat Athens, win the friendship of Persia, secure the gold of Persia so we can pay rowers, oarsmen, to power our galleys, and then we will catch the Athenians unsuspecting and we will beat them. That's exactly what happened. Lysander was so puffed up with pride about this that he not only started a sort of Spartan empire, instead of letting all the Greeks be free, as had been the slogan 27 years earlier when Sparta started the Peloponnesian War, saying, "We are fighting for the liberty of the Greeks against these oppressive Athenians," the Spartans, led by Lysander, simply took over the Athenian Empire and now forced all those Greek cities to pay tribute to them. And where the Athenians had been quite just and quite rigidly adhering to a rule of law, the Spartans didn't obey any laws at all. Any Spartan was viewed as a tyrant whose word was law. The Greeks began to hate the Spartans in a way they had never hated the Athenians and began to long for freedom from their liberators. So this was the ironical situation that Xenophon found when he got back from Persia. The Persians, too, are beginning to resent the Spartans because the Spartans are beginning in their hubris, that word which we think just means arrogance, but to a Greek meant arrogant violence. Their hubris, the Spartans are beginning to attack Persian holdings. Lysander meant to be the sort of great invader of Persia who would have ultimately made himself king of Sparta. He was born not a commoner, but a noble Spartan who was not in the direct line to inherit one of the two royal positions as king. And he didn't like that. He felt he should be king. He tried to pull the oracles in to help him. He went to the oracles. He actually paid to have oracles pronounced that would declare that the Spartans should take steps which would result in Lysander becoming king. One of the oracles he went to was in Africa. Out in the Libyan desert, there was an oracle of Zeus Ammon that was very famous. It was at an oasis called the Oasis of Siwa. And Lysander went there to manipulate the oracles and get favorable pronouncements about his own claims to rule Sparta. So he came back to Sparta. The Spartans managed to get around him. And so he thought, well, if I can't be king myself, I will make a king of my choice and rule through him. Now, there was at this time a debate about who would succeed the old king who had just died, a king named Agis. This was the man whose wife had had a passionate affair with the Athenian Alcibiades, who we visited a few lectures ago, And everyone believed, and it's probably true, that her son was Alcibiades' child and not the child of the king of Sparta, her own husband. So Lysander fomented doubt about this boy and said, no, no, we must not have a half-Athenian on the throne of Sparta. Let's take this man. And he pointed to a kinsman of the dead king, a little fellow called Agesilaus. Now, the Spartans really prized physical stature and a strong, heroic bearing. Agesilaus was one of the shortest Spartans of his generation. He was sort of one of these stocky little bandy-legged guys that you could overlook in a crowd. And he had spent his early life avoiding notice. He'd adhered to all the rules of Spartan upbringing. He was quiet. He was obedient to his elders. No one really knew him. And Lysander, the kingmaker, thought, here's a perfect person with no character of his own who I can make king, and then I'll rule through him. Well, he couldn't have been more mistaken. As soon as Agesilaus became king of Sparta, he took over all of Lysander's plans. He said, if there is to be a war in Asia, I shall command it. He took Lysander along just as one of 30 advisors. And when Lysander tried to strike out a policy of his own, completely sidelined him and put Lysander, the great hero of Sparta a few years earlier, completely out of the picture. Agesilaus then waged war, incredibly vigorous war, against the Persians in Asia Minor, modern Turkey, fighting for control of those old Greek cities and even beyond. He was so successful that Sparta's former ally, the Persian satrap or provincial governor, Pharnabazos, who really was the mastermind and the friend of Sparta who enabled them to beat Athens, Pharnabazos called for a meeting with Agesilaus. And the two of them met on a grassy plain, and Pharnabazos was having his attendants, in normal Persian style, spread out the carpets on the grass and the cushions and the refreshments, and he saw Agesilaus, the Spartan, arrive and go over and sit on the cold, hard ground, cross-legged. No ceremony at all. And Pharnabazos walked over and just sat down right in front of him, ignoring all of the beautiful preparations, and said, why are you doing this to me? I was Sparta's friend. And now you are burning my farms. You are raiding my territory. I can't get dinner because you are forever destroying my crops. Is this any way to treat a friend? Is this justice? And Agesilaus was so ashamed, because he'd never really had anybody rebuke him for Sparta's faithlessness to Persia, that he was silent for a long time. And then finally he said, you have made me feel remorse for what we have done. I beseech you, leave your master, the great king of Persia, fight with us Spartans, and together we will win you a kingdom of your own. This is the first time anybody put into a satrap's head the idea of rebelling from their Persian overlord and setting up a province to be a new kingdom. Pharnabazos was too loyal to do that. He said, as long as the great king has appointed me his servant, I am loyal to him and to nobody else. And he got up and he walked off to his horse. And Agesilaus was very impressed with this and ran after him and said, I cannot help admiring you. I promise that in future I will leave your territory alone and only raid those of other Persian satraps. And Pharnabazos' son, who was with his father at this meeting, ran back to Agesilaus, gave him a gift and said, I want to make you my guest friend. And so in this way, a friendship, a formal friendship was formed between this king of Sparta and Pharnabazos. Unfortunately, damage had already been done. While Agesilaus was raiding, Pharnabazos, who held a lot of clout in the Persian system, had sent a messenger up the royal road from Asia Minor all the way to the king. He was at Babylon at this time, saying, the Spartans are attacking us. The only way to get them out of Asia is attack them at sea. Draw them away from our territory. We should be looking around for a naval commander. Now, this had always been the problem for Persia. How do we fight these Greeks who are the greatest seafarers around? They even surpass our Phoenicians who fight for us at sea. How do we do this? So the king, Artaxerxes II, began looking around for a commander. And amazingly, he found one who was in his own realms, who had tremendous experience and a fair amount of success, But this man was an Athenian. His name was Conon, Conon the Athenian. And after the last battle of the Peloponnesian War, at a place called Goat Rivers, Egos Potamoi, up in the Hellespont, Conon was the only Athenian commander who escaped the universal capture of the Athenian fleet on shore by Lysander and the Spartans. Conon had kept his men together while the others were in an undisciplined way, scattering away from the Athenian camp and resting and looking for a meal around in the countryside. Conon kept his crews tight by their ships, and as Lysander swept down without warning and captured the Athenians on shore, Conon got away with just 8 ships out of what had been a fleet of almost 200. Those 8 got away, and Conon, looking for a safe haven now that the whole world was going to be a Spartan domain, fled away to the island of Cyprus. We think today of Cyprus as a divided island, today divided between Greeks and Turks. In antiquity, it was divided between Greeks and Phoenicians. But one of the Greek kings was very friendly to the mainland Greeks. His name was Evagoras. His kingdom was centered at a little city called Salamis in Cyprus. And it was to that little city of Salamis, named for Salamis back by Athens, and founded by those Greeks who, after the collapse of Greek civilization in around 1200 BC, had gone to Cyprus as refugees. So they were cousins, sort of the Athenians. And Evagoras welcomed Conon and his 8 ships. Any commander with 8 good-trained crews and 8 good ram-tipped triremes is going to be welcome anywhere. And so Conon set himself up there. He had his son Timotheus with him. And he became this leader in exile. And to him came all of the Athenians who wanted to resist Sparta but couldn't do it at home. So here was this admiral who had won a number of, or participated at any rate, in a number of Athenian naval campaigns back in the glory days of Athens, and the king sent a message to him in 397 BC, appointing him admiral of the Persian fleet. Well, the Persian naval efforts, for the last 100 years, had always suffered from what I think of as erectile dysfunction. A lot of determination to follow through and a lot of fine talk up front, but it never came to anything. They just couldn't seem to deliver. And that's what happened now. The great king had told Conon he was admiral, but when Conon asked for ships from the cities of the Persian Empire that could have supplied them, the Phoenician cities, the Cilician cities, they sent back messages saying, well, it'll take a few years to get new ships built and to assemble the crews, and everything began to peter out, and he had a vision of the impotent result of all of this effort, and he wasn't going to put up with that. So he followed the trail of the 10,000 that we followed a couple of lectures ago. He wanted to see Artaxerxes himself, and he decided to go to Babylon to do it. So he crossed over to that port at Issos. He went inland to the Euphrates River, took a boat down the river to Babylon, which was the king's residence and was rapidly becoming a sort of unofficial additional capital of the great Persian Empire. Now he's in Babylon and he's ready to talk to Artaxerxes, but there's a problem. Persian kings had become very different from what they were in the days of Cyrus the Conqueror, back in the 150 years earlier, back in the mid-6th century, when the Persians were young, vigorous conquerors spreading out across the globe, and the king was everywhere, at the front of his forces, talking to enemies and friends alike. Now the king was an unapproachable figure. He was surrounded by the court. You had to petition for a chance to speak to him. There was no meaningful dialogue, and the ceremonies were things that the Greeks just found abhorrent. And the most abhorrent of all was what was called proskynesis, getting down on your knees, kowtowing. You had to kiss your hand to the king. You had to bow. It seems, apparently, some of the Greeks even called it prostration. You had to just almost lie on the floor before the king would recognize you and allow you to speak. Part of the idea of Greek eleutheria, freedom, is not just the freedom of your city, it's the freedom of yourself. You are an independent free man. You don't bow to anyone. To do that would be what the Greeks called slavish. And when Socrates, as recorded in Plato's dialogues, wants to tell a young Athenian to act in the right way, stand up for yourself, be a virtuous man, he says, don't be slavish. Don't be someone who obeys the orders of others. Think for yourself, act for yourself. So it was inconceivable that Conan should ever go into the presence of Artaxerxes because he would have had to bow. There's a funny story that one Greek ambassador from the city of Thebes was so upset when told he had to bow to the great king in order to have an audience with him that he dropped his ring on the floor in front of him and then reached over to scoop it up so that the rest of his Greek embassy could be told by him later, I was just picking up my ring, but Artaxerxes would have seen, or whichever great king it was, would have seen this bow. At any rate, Conan and Artaxerxes stayed in separate rooms. They sent go-betweens back and forth. Conan listed his complaints about this failure of the Persians to follow through on the naval effort, and Artaxerxes, respecting him tremendously, agreed to all of his demands. So he confirmed Conan as admiral. He gave him more funds, all the funds he wanted, to pay his crews. Let's not forget that these aren't slaves who are rowing these ships, 170 rowers in each trireme, and they've all got to be paid every day. And he gave Conan a tremendous war chest. He sent orders to the satraps and the local rulers that they must obey this man's requests for ships and for men. And finally he said to Conan through the go-betweens, I would like you to have a Persian to command with you. Part of the reason people had been slow was Conan, of course, is an Athenian. They have been the demons in Persian eyes for so long that he is not a congenial figure for these Persian types to collaborate with. And Conan, knowing very well the reputation of Pharnabazos for fairness and for valor, asked for Pharnabazos, the satrap of Asia Minor. So that was agreed to by Artaxerxes. And as soon as Pharnabazos, who you may remember riding his stallion into the sea, almost to try to attack the Athenian ships on horseback up in the Hellespont. And we just saw him being very plain and straightforward with Agesilaus there at that meeting on the grass. He comes down to the sea, he joins Conan, and together they put together a big fleet very quickly and head west toward the Aegean to meet the Spartans. The Spartans learn that they are coming because during all the months of delay that were driving Conan crazy, a merchantman, a freighter from the city of Syracuse in Sicily, a traditional enemy of Athens ever since the Syracusan expedition of 415 to 413 BC, this sea captain was in the harbor at Cyprian Salamis, saw the preparations for this invasion, realized what was going on, and hurried off to tell the Spartans back home, you're about to be attacked at sea. Agesilaus probably should have commanded the defense at sea himself, this new king of Sparta. Instead, he appointed, in an act of true and despicable nepotism, his own brother-in-law to be admiral, a man named Peisander, who had no naval experience, whose only recommendation was he was the king's kinsman. Peisander was not a sensible person. He was not a person who understands tactics. He just thought the way to win battles was the Spartan way. Go straight at them. Don't hesitate. Be the bravest and you will win. And we all know by this time, having seen Themistocles at Salamis and some of these other great naval tacticians, that it's not like a hoplite battle on land. It's not two lines of men confronting each other and having a shoving match along the front line and see who can shove the hardest. Naval battles are won by tactics, by stratagems, by knowing the terrain, knowing your enemy. Peisander didn't understand that. He took his fleet to a city at the absolute southwest corner of Asia Minor, a beautiful city called Cnidos, sacred to the goddess Aphrodite. We may not immediately associate Aphrodite with the sea. We think of her as the goddess of erotic love, beauty. But the Greeks thought of her as a great deity of the sea. She was supposed to have been born from the foam of the sea near the island of Cyprus. Cnidos was on a promontory sticking far out into the sea, and her temple was up on a height, looking out to the horizon over the blue waters where the Aegean met the eastern Mediterranean. So under the goddess's gaze, the Spartans marshaled their forces, and Conan sent spies and scouts ahead to find out how big they were. He discovered that they had a smaller fleet than his once he'd combined with Pharnabazos and all of these Athenian ships, because so many Athenians had flocked to his standard now. They were desperate to get their city back on its feet, and he seemed their only hope. So he had a bigger fleet than the Spartans did, and not knowing what an idiot Peisander was, he assumed it would take some stratagem to lure him into battle. Half of winning a battle is often persuading your enemy to fight a battle that they shouldn't, a battle that, in fact, they would be destined to lose and would know it if they understood the whole situation. So he pulled that same stunt that we saw Alcibiades pulling at Cyzicus. He took his own little Athenian squadron as a vanguard and paraded across the bay in front of Cnidos with Pharnabazos behind with the main body of the Phoenicians and the Cilicians and the other Persian ships hidden. Well, Peisander saw this tempting target, these few Athenian ships, the hated Athenians, like a red rag to a bull, and he loaded all of his men onto the ships and launched his full force immediately and set off in pursuit of these Athenians. Conan then swung his fleet around to face this charge from Peisander and the Spartans. Now, I say the Spartans, but the Spartans have no seafaring tradition. They're like the Persians in that. These are not Spartan ships or Spartan men or Spartan rowers or pilots. They're all mercenaries. They're all hirelings from Asia Minor or from the islands or from the Greek cities that the Spartans have basically conquered. And many of them don't like the Spartans at all. They're just their paymasters. So this is not a good situation for Peisander. At any rate, he plunged into the midst of the Athenian fleet. They were battling hard when suddenly the left wing, or the left horn, as the Spartans would have called it, of their naval formation, was able to see, rounding the point, Pharnabazos and the main body of the enemy fleet. They thought they were attacking the whole thing with this Athenian vanguard, and here was a fleet that outnumbered them, fresh, ready for combat, and showing up across the sea. They all abandoned Peisander the Spartan, turned for shore, and fled. Peisander saw this happen. He kept on fighting. He was ultimately killed. And as soon as he was seen to die, all of those Spartan-backed ships turned and ran for shore. Now, we've seen it again and again, starting with Marathon. In a rout, you've got your undefended back to the enemy. The casualties can be huge. Conan and Pharnabazos managed to snap up 50 enemy triremes in the short run from the field of battle out in the bay before they got to the shore. Thousands of the enemy oarsmen leapt overboard and swam to shore, trying to escape from the Athenians and the Persians. And even with that, they did manage to capture 5,000 others as prisoners. And this is a great deal in ancient warfare because you can ransom your prisoners, and that helps pay for the campaign. So it's a tremendous victory for the Athenians and for the Persians. And I just want you to reflect on the irony here, piled on irony, that now Athens and Persia, which were in the year 480 BC, almost a century earlier, confronted vicious enemies to each other, fighting it out at the Battle of Salamis, and finally the Athenians beating the Persians and launching their golden age under the banner of resistance to Persia. Now they're the best of friends, fighting against Athens' former ally, Sparta. Well, word got around immediately of this disaster. It came to Agesilaus, the king of Sparta, when he was campaigning. He was already back in Greece at this point. And we know all about it because Xenophon, our hero of the March of the 10,000, looking for a congenial leader to whom to hitch his own star, has joined Agesilaus. And he was there on the day when word came of the defeat of the Spartan fleet at Cnidos. And he was there when the messenger came to Agesilaus' tent there, the Spartan army's tent, and said, "We have lost a great battle at Cnidos. The Spartan navy is destroyed." And on that day, there was an eclipse of the sun. We've had one earlier when Xerxes set out on his great march to invade Greece. There was an eclipse of the sun there. The Greeks always viewed eclipses as portents of disaster. And so Agesilaus, fearing that this might be the end of the Spartan Empire, went out and lied to the troops, because word was percolating everywhere. "There's been a great battle. My brother-in-law Peisander fell valiantly fighting for Sparta, but the navy won. We are still masters of the sea." He wanted to keep his own men's courage and heart up, and he didn't want the enemies of Sparta, who were surrounding them at this point, he knew a battle was in the offing, he didn't want them to know, or they would have fought with renewed vigor against him. Well, the battle happened very shortly after that at a place called Coronea, and although Agesilaus survived, he fell in the front line. He was leading as Spartan kings do in the front. He was so small, so short, he got pushed over in the crush of the phalanx and trampled on, almost killed. and his officers finally pulled him out and got him back on his feet. He survived the battle. The Spartans were not beaten, but it was a tactical victory for their enemies, the Thebans and the other states, the old allies of Sparta, like Corinth and Athens, that are now fighting against Sparta. He made his way home, and that was the end of the Spartan Empire, this battle of Coronea on land, this great defeat of the naval forces at sea. That might have been the end of it. Conan was allowed with his son Timotheus to go around to the Greek cities in Asia and in the Aegean and liberate them from their Spartan governors. And if they had managed to just end it there, probably there would have then been this equipoise, Athens and Sparta, sort of in balance. But there was one Spartan, Dercyllidas, up at Abydos on the Hellespont, that city where the south end of Xerxes' bridges had been anchored back in 480 BC. They had a Spartan governor, Dercyllidas, who would not give up and was so popular with the local people, he said, "We can defy the world." And he sort of infused them with this desire. Well, it would have been a lot better for Sparta if he had been defeated and thrown out with the rest, because Abydos was in the satrapy of Pharnabazos. And Pharnabazos, getting home after this big naval effort and beating the Spartans at sea, is enraged to discover at his doorstep another Spartan still hanging on, still denying him access to the Hellespont. And he went back to Conan and said, "We are going to Greece." So they gathered in the following spring, 393 BC, they gathered the navy again and they crossed over to Greece. They took the island of Cythera, that beautiful island sacred to Aphrodite off the southern tip of Sparta. They put in an Athenian governor. They went up to the Isthmus of Corinth. Pharnabazos, Persian satrap and prince, went ashore on Greek soil, was an honored guest of the Athenians, the Corinthians, the Thebans, all of the anti-Spartan Greeks. And he said, "Keep fighting this war against Sparta," all because of that annoying Spartan up in Abydos. "Keep fighting the war. I will fund you. I will give you treasure. I will give you gold." And when Conan asked him for the fleet to remain in Athens to carry on the war at Sparta's doorstep, he said to Pharnabazos the magic words, "If you do this, you will hurt the Spartans more than you could do in any other way. If you take away from them the rule of the sea, if you restore Athens and Athens' naval power, as you are the only man in the world that could do, you will have injured them more deeply than you imagine." This was music to Pharnabazos' ears. He left that fleet of ships with Conan. He left Conan a tremendous war chest. Conan went back to Athens. Pharnabazos went back to Asia Minor. And Conan, received like a hero at the Piraeus, was able to bring back Athens seemingly from the dead. With those ships, he reinstituted the Athenian navy. With all that money, he rebuilt the long walls that linked Athens to the port of Piraeus, so once again the city was impregnable by attack on land, and he rebuilt the Piraeus, which in the years after the fall of Athens had been wrecked. No one wanted to see this emblem of Athenian sea power ever a strong naval base again. He rebuilt it. The Athenians, wanting a sort of presiding genius to hover over the Piraeus, remembered Themistocles, that sea hero of long ago who had won the Battle of Salamis for them with his stratagems and his tricks. They built for him a monument on the point of land. You can still see it today at the entrance to the great harbor at the Piraeus, the one that faces west into the Straits of Salamis. Archaeologists found this little place where a monument to Themistocles was set up, and there was an inscription: "Here you lie on a high point of land. You look on the merchantmen coming from all the world. You see the galleys racing in and out from this place." And in addition to a cult of Themistocles, which the Athenians in general took over to do justice to him, Conan built a temple to Aphrodite, Aphrodite of the fair voyage, because she's the goddess who'd looked out over his great victory in Cnidos. And in the new Athenian golden age that was launched by this victory and this restoration of Athens, the golden age of the philosopher Plato, the orator Demosthenes, there was a great sculptor, Praxiteles, who glorified the female form as no one ever had done before. The Greeks had been kind of hung up on male nudes up to this time. The first person to show a female nude was Praxiteles, and he created, what else? A famous statue of Aphrodite to go in that temple at Cnidos, where the sea battle that turned the world's history around had been fought. She was shown with her robe slipping off her, getting ready to step into her bath, that goddess who was part of the element of water. And she was so beautiful, front and back, that they put doors at the rear of the temple so people who wanted to see her 360 degrees could get in there and admire her from the rear as they did from the front. So all this feeling of happiness, of joy that Athens had never thought to experience again came back with Conan, with Pharnabazos, with the turn of their fortunes, and we have truly seen in almost a space of just a decade the world turned upside down.